Cord to this computer. Okay, so we're running. Hello, everyone. This is Kevin Andrew Richards from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign here to host another episode of the Playing with Research in Health and Physical Education podcast segment that we call Going Behind the Research. Rather than providing a forum to discuss research that is conducted in health and physical education, the Going Behind the Research segment focuses on telling stories that surround research that we read in scholarly journals. Globally, the segment aims to humanize research by providing a forum to discuss the motives that draw researchers towards topics and studies, challenges and successes experienced along the way, and lessons learned that transcend individual journal publications and impact future research decisions. Each episode will feature an interview with one or more members of an authorship team to discuss the stories behind a selected publication, including a brief overview of the study. The common set of questions will be used to facilitate each individual conversation. As has happened, however, these conversations tend to be unique, as the follow-up questions that I'll ask in the ensuing conversation kind of goes different directions depending upon the interviewee. With that said, I'm really excited to welcome with us today Oscar Nunez Enriquez, who is going to talk about the article that he co-authored with Kim Oliver, titled "The Collision of Two Worlds: When a Teacher-Centered Facilitator Meets a Student-Centered Pedagogy." That article is published in Sport Education and Society, and we'll link it in the show notes to the episode. Oscar, thank you so much for being with us today.
Kevin, thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so just to get us started, before we get behind the research, please give us a brief overview of the study with the reminder that the article, as I mentioned a second ago, will be linked in the show notes of the episode for anybody who's interested in reading more.
So basically, it summarizes my life as a doctoral student and the challenges that I faced while learning a new pedagogical perspective coming from a male-dominated country that I never thought it was so ingrained in my academic and personal life. So it basically summarizes how I struggled with those challenges, even though that I knew that this new learning was beneficial for my students. I was kind of like facing that struggle of why do I have to leave my power, quote unquote, teacher and listen to my students.
Yeah.
And it was something that I was taught from an early age that everything needed to come from me. So when learning this new approach with Kim, it was the main struggle that I faced. And of course, that also, made me realize on other struggles in different levels, personal levels and academic levels. But basically from an autoethnographic perspective, it summarizes how I felt and how I dealt with those challenges and how it set the tone for me to become a new researcher and teacher in higher education.
Wow. My head is spinning in like 1,000 different directions. As somebody who studies socialization, it's super, super interesting to me. It's almost, you didn't couch it this way, but I would almost view this as like research into your own socialization experience, and that can lead you to question some of the assumptions that are ingrained from a very young age. So I don't want to go there though, because I think that would take us out of time. but the vulnerability that it takes first to do this work, and then to write about it and to put it out there for others is really astounding, and so commendable. So I wonder if that might be a good place to start. How does it feel to do that, to conduct this type of inward looking scholarship that requires you to be vulnerable and allow your beliefs to be challenged, and then share that out with others through publication?
And that was the first challenge that I faced. Vulnerability, one of the things that I thought it was weakness. So I never wanted to show myself as a weak person, even though that I was the newcomer to this new research group. But as I was taught that as a male, I needed to provide for my family. I needed to be strong. I needed to do solo work. I needed to do a lot of things that I never expected to be challenged. And then when I started learning about the student-centered pedagogy, I just started realizing that you need to portray yourself vulnerable in certain capacity, not as open as we would expect, but in a certain capacity as a teacher. But then me being vulnerable meant I was a weak teacher, and I was not willing to portray that with my students. And that was the first challenge. Then I came to realize that that was my biggest strength, because that shows that you have the ability to understand others in a different level.
Yeah.
But it took me a while to understand it and face it and realize it. And Kim challenged me in different ways that I never expected. And with this new group and this research group with Carlo Luwetti and then Raquel Aranda, that was the second challenge, because I was the only male in a female, a more female group. And it's like, okay, so I'm the male. I needed to be the leader. Why am I being led by women? And that's something that challenged as well in a different level. But those two challenges came together, and it took me a while to understand that they weren't weaknesses. They were just the opportunity for me to overcome something and set up from a different perspective the cornerstone of how can I become a different teacher and researcher as well.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. So kind of getting back to the planned questions that I have, let's start a bit broad. What got you interested in this research topic or area more generally, and how does this study fit into your broader line of inquiry?
So yeah, basically, so I taught in the Mexican educational system for over 13 years. And by year nine, 10, my students were literally asking me to do something different. And I knew in me that I needed to do something different, but I didn't know what it was. So as an undergrad student, I did a exchange program to New Mexico State University. So that's where I met Kim. But then I went back to Mexico and started teaching. But over the years, I kept in touch with her, and she kind of like set me up with ideas and everything. But then one time she sent me an email that they were creating a PhD program if I was interested in applying to. Then, okay, seeing her work, having her as teacher, like, okay, this is something different that I needed to do. Then I started realizing that it was what my students were asking me, that they wanted to be listened, that they wanted to their voice to be heard and be part of the class. But I never realized it was so much of a challenge because of the struggles of, okay, I'm the teacher. You need to listen to me. You need to do what I'm planning. All the things that I'm doing is for your benefit. So, but what you're telling me, no, we're not doing that. And it was a part of knowing deep in me that I needed to do something different, even though that I wasn't clear enough of what I was thing that I needed to do. And I think this feeling of knowing deep inside me that I needed to do something different for my students, that's what fueled me to keep going.
Yeah.
To progress in that struggle and face it and open up myself to, this is it. This is what you were looking for. It hurt, but this is what you were looking for.
Yeah. And so that notion then that you're speaking of there is that shift from more of a teacher-dominated approach to a student-centered approach. So you kind of felt as if a change was needed, and that was the change broadly that ended up being the one that was needed.
Yes. Basically, it's like I knew that I needed to do something different. I wasn't sure what was it. The opportunity presented itself. I took it. I struggled with it. And then I realized this is the what I was looking for. And it put me in a different spot and in a different position for me to learn, not only to become a better teacher, quote unquote, but to become a researcher that understands from a different perspective the challenges that your students are facing, but also to understand the struggles that a lot of teachers are facing as well.
Yeah. So I think the natural follow-up question here is to kind of narrow the focus a little bit. So could you tell us about the circumstances surrounding this particular study? You know, what brought you to this specific purpose or research question?
So the main research question that we wanted to ask is how I overcame the struggles of becoming a more student-centered facilitator instead of me being a teacher-centered facilitator. And it was a four-year project. So I kept a journal as a doctoral student. And that helped me to kind of realize the struggles that I faced on a daily basis. We had weekly meetings. We had a lot of projects in between. And it was high dense in the literature of student-centered pedagogies. And all those things kind of like pushed me one step at a time to realize that I needed to portray, that I needed to tell other folks that the struggles are real. And it, it's okay to have these struggles and face them. Because otherwise, how are you going to know, how are you going to help others with your knowledge?
Yes. So how long did it take you? I'm wondering, how long did it take you to acknowledge that? Because what it's sounding like to me is that your kind of espoused pedagogy, or the pedagogy that you believed, student-centered pedagogy, was inconsistent.
Well, it was.
It was inconsistent with maybe what was ingrained inside of you. From a young age through your own teacher education, et cetera, et cetera. So at what point did you realize, or were you able to admit that there was an inconsistency, or could you acknowledge that from the start?
Probably during my fourth year as a doctoral student. That was when I realized that it was okay to be uncomfortable. I mean, to feel comfortable with uncomfortable situations.
Yes. Because
year one, it was it wasn't the worst year, but it was the year that I struggled the most. Because I wasn't willing to ask for help. I wasn't willing to provide my feedback. I wasn't willing to even do something. Even though sometimes Kim pointed those to me directly. And I was like, no, I'm just listening. I'm not going to do much. You know, like, I wasn't willing to open up myself.
Yeah.
Year two, I started feeling more comfortable with the uncomfortableness of it, but I still wasn't willing to ask for help.
Yep.
Year three, I felt better, but until year four, that's when I realized it's okay to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I just realized that maybe all my academic life is going to be in between. There's a word from native Mexicans that they call it nepantla, which means in between. You are caught in the middle, because you're not, you can, I mean, that's one of the things I feel, that sometimes I feel that I'm caught in the middle, because I still struggle daily on being a teacher-centered facilitator and a student-centered facilitator as well.
Yep.
But I'm aware of cutting myself. Oh, I'm doing this. So let's go back to this. And I'm going to be always in between.
Yeah.
That's okay, because that provides me with an opportunity to understand both worlds.
Right.
Both positionalities and to see that the struggles are fine, but you can overcome them and come this way.
Yeah, yeah.
Or sometimes like, okay, I don't agree with this. Let me find that safe space that I need to reflect and then go back. You know, like, it's one of those positionalities where you feel comfortable enough with that uncomfortableness of being in between.
Yeah, yeah. I love that idea of being in between and giving ourselves permission to exist in, you know, there's another word that comes to mind for how you describe that, liminality. Like a liminal space is sometimes a between space. I'm not sure if that's synonymous with the concept that you introduced or not, but that idea of it, I don't have to be either or. I can be in between, and that's a constant struggle, and that's okay. It's okay to not always be perfect. It's okay to have moments where maybe you kind of stray a little bit and go more teacher-centered. It's the reflection and the self-accountability that helps you to reground yourself. I'm kind of interpreting on the
Your
sense.
Yeah, it completely makes sense. That was the struggle that I faced. Like, okay, it's okay to be in the middle. It's okay because that shows that you were willing to step up,
right,
and keep moving forward. You know, like, you're not in the place you were. You're now in a different place, in a new place, in a from a different lens. You can see how things work now,
right?
Because you can turn around and see, okay, this helped me a lot. I don't need it anymore, but it helped me to be here.
Yes,
it pushed me to be here, but now I can turn the other way around and like, okay, that's the place where I want to go. I'm not there yet, but I'm can be capable of going back and forth to understand both worlds and create that new learning space for my students. Because now that I'm teaching my undergrad students, and I see their struggles like similar to me.
Yeah,
and that notion of understanding those struggles and in challenging them in different ways, and not only be harsh on, you gotta face it. No, you can be as empathetic enough to understand them and tell them, you know what, it's okay, but you gotta step up. You gotta feel that, and because you're gonna be teaching students who are gonna be challenging those struggles as well.
Yep.
So you can be that person that helped them out to understand those and overcome and become physically active.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. That's really cool, Oscar. What a great way to be able to relate to your students and kind of be able to communicate, hey, I was there too. Like, I get it. I understand. It's okay to struggle. So thank you for sharing that, and what a cool way for you to be able to connect. So just to pivot a little bit, if you could talk to us about the methods of this study. I know that you couched it using critical autoethnography. So talk to us maybe a little bit about that and what, from a methodological perspective, you've learned that you continued to carry with you from this project.
So a difference between autoethnography and critical autoethnography is that you are criticizing yourself.
Yeah.
And something really, that can be really, really uncomfortable for some researchers.
Sure.
Because that puts you in a spot where you need to actually go deep inside of you and see the struggles and the wounds that those struggles have created in different ways. But be willing to show them in a different way, in a way that can be understood from others, and show them that this is a new positionality for researchers that can become something important within their field. So from that perspective, I wanted to portray the struggles and how I managed the learning this student-centered pedagogy from year to year, because data that we collected was from 4 years, but most of the data came from the year four. And one of the things that helped me to realize is that without knowing, I was doing a autoethnography project, because keeping this journal for me was, it was something that helped me to understand my struggles on a daily basis.
Yep.
And also helped me to learn that, because I was then, this wasn't a challenge that I put on the paper, but it was a challenge that I was having struggle with. Being bilingual, sometimes I wrote things in Spanish and some other in English, and when I started reading it, like, it doesn't make any sense. But my mind was something that was dealing with the notion of going in between languages. But it was something else. But that keeping the journal helped me to keep my ideas together. And basically, on the methodology, we wanted to portray how this struggle of 4 years can be something that you can report, and not only to report it, only to show the research world that it is okay to show yourself in this way, because most of the stories that we portray are from a third person, not from a first person perspective.
Yep.
And we wanted to write it in a first person perspective in that way so that we can actually relate with the struggles of one person, in this case myself, that is facing, to learn different things coming from a quote unquote old world, you know?
Yeah. Well, love that. Thank you. So kind of spiraling off from there, how did this study inform your scholarly identity or future research activities? In other words, what did you learn here that influenced the work that came after it?
It helped me to realize that my positionality will be always be in between. That I won't be able, probably, it's a way to become 100% student-centered researcher. But I'm not going back to become a teacher-centered facilitator at all. And being caught in between helped me to realize that, see and understand and translate the struggles from people who are coming to that, to a different world. And that's okay. And it put me in the spot of helping others to understand those struggles. And I think my positionality from there is always to be the facilitator of learning. And I'm that person of pulling or pushing students to a different world that they are facing. That has created that positionality in me that I'm probably gonna be always in this in between, or at least for now. I don't know what is gonna happen in 5 or 10 years, but now this is the place that I need to be, and this is the place that I feel that I need to be. And understanding that those things has helped me to realize that you can collaborate with others to understand different perspective. And that's something that has happened with other colleagues in Mexico and also in the United States and Europe as well, because you understand similarities. And one of the things that helped me to realize is that it's okay. We already told you that it's okay to be in the middle. It's okay to be in a pantla, which is a safe space zone for you to see where your next step should be. Because you're in a different spot. You're in a different place right now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And what a good kind of orientation as a researcher, especially a qualitative researcher, where the social world is evolving. Research design and approach are emergent, and things need to change. That flexibility and mindset to be able to recognize that I don't have to be a certain way, I don't have to be perfect all of the time, gives you kind of flexibility to be human. It humanizes you, and it humanizes research.
Exactly. And also, coming from a male-dominated country, where like most of the decision making should come from men, it helped me to humanize myself and let others to take that decision without me having the struggle of making that decision, which is okay as well, because that put me in a spot where, okay, I'm willing to flex myself in different dimensions where I don't need to make that right decision, quote unquote, but to be willing to ask for help, to be willing to let others to do those decisions without help. I mean, me struggling. But at the same time, one of the things that I've noticed is that being a male in a male-dominated country, people listen as you most. So humanizing myself and me being in between and showing the world that I'm in right now that it's okay to be in between has helped me to humanize other researchers, to see the student's perspective in a different way.
From
their own line of research, from their own approaches. And it's okay. It's not that you're giving up your quote unquote power as a teacher. It's that you are just seeing in between lines or seeing beyond the students' voices. What do they need? And that has something that I've taken advantage of my privileges in certain ways. But from this positionality of being me in the middle as a researcher as well.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much for that. So this is my second favorite question to ask. Do you have any stories accompanying the process of completing this investigation that you feel comfortable sharing that give us a look under the hood? Bonus points if you've got something that could.
So year one, when we started at the after school club, Kalalu Wedi and myself, we were running the club. We are both from Latin American countries. We share a lot of similarities. And we never realized that we were doing this until Kim pointed out this to us. Kim is really, Carla and myself, we are really competitive. So there were some kids playing. I can't remember the game we were playing, but we were playing with the kids in the after school club. And we were leaving the girls behind. We weren't passing the ball to the girls, Carla included, because we just wanted to win. And Kim was observing the class, and Kim didn't say anything at all during that time. And it was until we gathered and on our weekly debriefing meetings that Kim pointed out that to us, like, did you notice that you were leaving the girls behind? We're like, no. Okay, so I counted how many passes you made to the boys and how many passes you made with the girls. You made passes because we were passing the ball each other in order to score. With the boys, we made 36 passes. And with the girls, we just made like 3 or 4. So like, and that was something that even Carla, they had more experience with the student-centered pedagogy, struggled with, that there was something that she needed to focus in, myself as well. Like, okay. So we were overtaking the game. So let's just the kids play, and we're gonna just facilitate, not win the game. That was something really funny. At the moment, it wasn't funny at all. But then it was like, no, that was really, really funny, because in the game, without realizing, we were leaving the kids behind because we wanted to win.
Yep.
Like, okay.
It gets the best of all of us sometimes. And then
exactly.
If somebody points it out to you, sometimes you don't see it.
Exactly, yes. But the most interesting part was that Kim let us do it. And because she saw, like, okay, this is something they're going to learn from.
Yes.
I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to point it out in the right moment.
Yep.
And she pointed out, like, oh my God. And then, that was our story for year two or three. They were like, okay, do not overtake the game. You're like, no, I'm not going to overtake the game. And something that helped us to realize, okay, you need to see it and do different things every day.
Yeah. Wonderful. So before we close out the segment, is there anything else you'd like to share about this paper that we've not been able to talk about yet?
So one of the things that paper made me realize is how ingrained my cultural background was without me realizing that it was. I needed to be outside of my own culture to understand those struggles. And even though that Kim and myself, we had a good but rough relationship because of that, she pushed me in different levels to understand, in academic perspective, those struggles that affected my own personal life. And one of the things that I would like others to start challenging themselves is how your own beliefs and how your own ways of teaching or your own ways as a person will affect your teaching. And that's something that it will be part of your teaching without you realizing that it's being part of it. So start questioning small questions like, okay, why do I like sports? And am I teaching only sports in my curriculum? And is it because I just like sport, or is it because sports should be the main goal of my curriculum? Because as for me, one of the things that I realized is it was that I don't like, well, it's not that I don't like it. Dancing is not my best interest. But when I started realizing that I wasn't including dancing enough in my curriculum, it was like, okay, you need to incorporate it without thinking that just because you don't like it, it's okay for the students. Like, your kids want it, go for it. And it's okay for you to show yourself vulnerable. I only struggle with that word. Vulnerable as a teacher. Because that shows your students the willingness of doing something uncomfortable in order to learn something new. And that puts you in a different perspective with your students as well.
Yeah.
But that takes time. And you have to be willing to take that time with you as well.
Yeah. That's awesome. Thanks so much, Oscar. So now, before we close out, my favorite question that I get to ask. Because we're trying to get to know the stories behind the research, it's fun to end with some rapid fire questions that help us get to know you a little bit better. I have six categories. Are you comfortable giving me your quickest response?
Okay, yes.
And I think if I remember right, you knew that this was happening, but you don't know the categories.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So favorite color?
Blue.
Blue. Okay. All right. I was going to guess red with that shirt. Favorite animal?
Dogs.
Me too. Favorite season of the year?
Winter.
Ooh, you know, a lot of people go with summer. Why winter?
I don't know. I never liked summer. Mm. For some reason, I never liked summer even when I was a kid.
Yep. So I feel the same way. I've always preferred a little bit colder. I don't like to be
really cold. like fall.
Yeah.
Winter in between it. It's yeah, I like it better.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Favorite place on earth?
Man, I got several places. So there's a place here in Chihuahua. It's deep in the mountains called Creel. But really in Creel, there's like a track, like an hour track, walking track. And there's a rock right on there on the canyons where you can just sit.
Yeah.
You like enjoy yourself. And that's one of my favorite places that I would like to be, you know, like nothing there. Just like you can be yourself. Enjoy that moment for as long as you want to. And yes. And there's another place that, the city had it, but they don't have it anymore. How did the word in Spanish, but it's like, the place we went to in Chile where they have the elevator and the, okay. So there's a place similar there was a place in Chihuahua that I like to go there and just stay there thinking about nothing.
Yep. So very peaceful.
Yes, very peaceful. And that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. So two more. Favorite food?
Do not get me started on that. Okay. Okay. Mexican food, enchiladas.
Uh-huh.
I like to make them myself with different chiles, cheese. I like to do the whole process. Another food that I like, and my mom used to make it. It is like a stew, chile colorado stew, beef, potatoes, and red chili.
Yep.
Uh-huh. And there's a soup that I really enjoy eating with my daughter. It's like the fideo, like some sort of a how do you translate that? Okay, it's a soup that I learned how to cook to my daughter, and she enjoys it with like a lot, and like okay, and that's one of the meals that we share with. I mean, we share, and it's not a really expensive or a complicated dish, but it's something that we really enjoy.
That's awesome. Cool. Last question. Favorite thing to drink?
Man, okay. Nowadays it's wine, red wine, but I really like alcoholic beverages, whiskey, and non-alcoholic beverages, lemonade. But mineral water.
Yep. The bottle of Sotol from Chile came back with us, and I finished it with Emily's family.
Nice, yeah. That's something really, it's really smooth, it's really, yeah.
Yeah. Her brother-in-law is from Mexico. It was really impressed that we had a bottle of soda.
See?
So thank you for that. You're earning me bonus points with the family. Thank you so much, Oscar. I really appreciate you spending some time with me today. The paper related to this podcast, the link in the show notes, if you're interested in reading more. Really great conversation. Appreciate your perspective and your time.
No, thank you. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having me.